Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week I'm here with Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Not bad, thanks. How about you? Nice to catch up with you in person last week.
Yeah, it was good. We had a very nice curry. Me and Chris went out with a couple of friends in the storage industry, talked storage and ate nice food.
It was good. It was good fun. It was good to see Mr. Miller as well. Don't see him very often.
No, he's always, and Chris is always good value.
Absolutely. Right, this week we have a guest, Andy Klein from Backblaze is joining us. Hi, Andy.
Hi, good afternoon or good evening. Well, thank you for inviting me today.
Would you just mind giving people a 30-second brief on who you are and what you do for the company?
Sure. My name is Andy Klein, and I've been with Backblaze for a little over 7 years now, most of the time in product marketing and working with everything from the hard drive stats and things of that nature all the way over to storage pods and then just general marketing of the products and so on and so forth. Recently, interestingly enough, just moved over to our compliance group. So now I get to actually tell people that they're doing it wrong.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it'll be a lot of fun, but looking forward to this today.
You didn't have MySpace as a customer then?
No, we did not.
Okay, wonderful. So let's talk about Backblaze as a company. Some people might know the company from the backup solution, but obviously it's more than that now.
Yeah, we started out, as you said, in online backup or cloud backup, depending on your term you want to use, and started there for consumers for the most part, and then small businesses. And that grew over time, and we were doing quite nicely. And about 2015 or so, we said, you know, we have a lot of storage and people want to use it. Maybe we should put together something that's like a cloud storage offering. So we went down that road. We looked at some of the industry leaders that do that and said, yeah, we can do this. And oh, by the way, we can do it for a whole lot less than they're doing it. And we introduced what we call B2 cloud storage. And so we do both online storage and cloud storage, and that certainly has appeals to organizations of all sizes.
So our conversation really today is to talk about one aspect of that part of the business, and that's the fact that you went off and decided, obviously from a cost perspective, both I guess for B2 and for the original business, but you went off and decided to build your own storage pods rather than buying traditional storage from vendors, and that's obviously been an entire project in its own right within the company.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually one of the things where they set up the gauntlet early on. They said, we wanted to offer online storage, unlimited online storage to consumers for $5 a month. And so they said, that's our goal. And then they went out and they said, well, wait a minute, if we were going to go and go to with Amazon, for example, and use S3, we can only store about 35 gigabytes of data for people. And that one obviously wasn't going to work. So we started looking around and we looked at some of the other providers at the time, Dell and HP and all of those, and it was still ridiculously expensive. And so we set out to go design and build our own and found it to be, almost an order of magnitude less expensive to doing what we did. Because there were no middlemen or anything like that. We could have the parts built locally. We sourced consumer parts, put them all together, tested them. And then from a storage perspective, once you get over the fact that drives fail and components fail, you design your software to deal with that. And that's what we did. So it was really the software that allowed you to use these types of components. And most of the other folks eventually caught up with that idea. But that's the way we started. And so it was really, really nice. And then we open sourced the design, and that was a great help because the open source community just loves to contribute. And so we got a lot of great ideas from them, and we improved the product over time. And people actually could go off, and quite frankly, a fair number of folks have gone off and built their own storage pods. We get stories about them from time to time. So it was a great idea.
So how many generations have there been of the storage pod so far?
I think seven is the right number. We were actually put together a storage pod museum just about 2 or 3 months ago. We even did a blog post about it. And I was going around our data centers collecting up all of the pieces that we had saved over the years, and we came up with seven generations of them. There's even some earlier ones that we had. The very first prototype we built was built out of plywood. We didn't have any customer data on it. It was a prototype, but it was the way we could put things together really quickly and test stuff out and understand routes and understand how components fit. And we didn't have to bend metal to do it. And then once we got that design down, then we actually went out and had a professional designer design it for us and so on. So,
okay. Martin, from your perspective, I don't know whether you've looked at any of the open source blueprints for the pods.
I did at one point, thought, oh, they'd be quite cool to build, and then realized I didn't really need to build them. Backblaze do it well enough already. And so I'm a happy customer. So,
okay. You never mentioned that before. That's interesting. There you go. Okay. Well, that's positive.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. You know, so it, but folks like yourself would look at that and say, yeah, I could do that, get the components, and certainly do variants of that. We had a lot of universities and stuff jump in and you know, say, hey, what if you replace this? And what if you do this? And, you know, I'm going to put this software on here and so on. So it's been fun over the years.
So before we get onto the hard drives in a moment, what about the software that you had on there? Was that entirely your own custom software? I mean, obviously people talk a lot about software-defined storage these days and SDS. I guess there wasn't sort of an off-the-shelf storage platform that you could just take and put on there.
No, it's our own. Obviously, we used some standard routines like, you know, RAID. We originally used RAID 6, and then eventually we rewrote our own encoding mechanisms, but erasure code mechanisms. But for the most part, it was standardized. We used a standard file system, for example, but and then our code on top of that on how to, you know, how to manage the data that was coming in, how to keep data consistent, you know, by running checks on it on a regular basis, how to make sure, obviously, that it's encrypted, stays encrypted, all of the types of things that you need to manage on top of that. So the user services and stuff that go on top of that, password, you know, password protections, password recovery, all of that, we wrote all of that.
I guess once you're into that development, there's a lot of work you have to do there. Now, in terms of the drives themselves, I remember seeing some incredible stories around how sometimes you had to actually prize drives out of consumer units and things like that when there was the drive shortages. It seems to be that your demand for storage is pretty intense. I'm not sure how much you're deploying a month. It'd be interesting to know that. But clearly, there is an issue in terms of supply sometimes in getting hold of these drives.
There certainly was. That was back in 2011, 2012. There was what's known in the industry as the Thailand drive crisis. And that's when they had a horrible flooding over in Thailand. And it took out, estimates are anywhere from 25% to 50% of the hard drive manufacturing capacity, you know, basically almost overnight. And a very tragic set of events over there. But all of a sudden, drives got really short and we had to get creative. You know, so we went to the consumer channel and bought drives out of the consumer channel. And then eventually we even bought external hard drives and we'd open them up. And when you open up an external hard drive, you find an internal drive inside that looks just like an internal drive that you could buy. And so we used those. And then, you know, and that worked for it was like 3 or 4 months at the time. It was really tough to get drives. And then things started to ease up. But it took a couple of years before things really finally got back to normal. Now we're up to about 750 or so petabytes of data that we currently have under management, which is pretty substantial. And we're adding, I just got told that we're adding at least 30 petabytes a month.
Wow. Martin, your opinion on that volume?
That's pretty large.
It's
a decent size. I mean, okay, so compared to some of the hyperscalers, it's still not huge, but yeah, you'll hit your exabyte fairly soon.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. We were just talking about, are we going to have an exabyte party? you know, and you're right, the big guys, you know, certainly are adding an exabyte every so often, but you know, you got to start somewhere, so.
Yeah,
absolutely. Martin, before we go on any further into the next section, any questions you want to add on this little piece?
Actually, the only question I had was going back in time for when you were stripping out drives out of external hard drives. Did you find any difference in reliability, or did you just generally find they were just exactly the same as the drives you'd buy off the shelf?
Yeah, it's a good question. So for the most part, the model numbers were identical once you opened them up. So, you know, an external drive was just an internal drive inside a casing. It's by the same model number. And when we went back and looked at that, because it was certainly worth looking at, we didn't see any significant difference. As a matter of fact, there's some indication that the external drives performed a little better, but it was well within a margin of error, so I wouldn't make that statement.
Yeah, so I've been doing that recently. I was looking at the price of external drives and internal drives, and I was just stripping out I was just buying the external drives and stripping out the internal drives because they're cheaper, which is just madness. So the plastic and the SATA to USB and converter is basically they're giving you that for free, even
for
less
free.
Than three.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the case back then, and you do see it now as well. The only thing you have to be careful of is unless you absolutely know that drive model that's inside that external unit, you may be getting something you didn't expect.
Yeah.
You know, so we've seen some of the larger drives now, you'll buy an 8 terabyte external unit, and it'll have an SMR drive in it. And that may not be what you're expecting. You may be expecting more of a traditional PMR drive. So you got to watch out for that.
Yeah, good tip.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario. And I remember when, well, let's call it 10 years ago, maybe slightly less. I know that when I was looking at a number of enterprise environments as part of an analysis project I was running, I'd actually go in and pull out the drive models because I was really interested to see what the high-end vendors were using in their deployments. And they were using SATA drives that when I looked them up on the website, were actually consumer drives. And it just made me think, this is very interesting that enterprise vendors are taking drives and putting them into systems and still charging them a pretty much full price. Now, it seemed that's, I always thought that was a bit sharp. But then again, if the drive's reliable enough, is that really such a big deal?
It's not a big deal. In that particular case, it may have been that the manufacturers or the, not the manufacturers, the providers there were putting their own firmware on. And so there's a premium for that because they develop their own firmware and such. We've seen that before where somebody will take a consumer drive and have the manufacturer like Seagate, for example, install their firmware. And so that may be a bit of a premium for the firmware because you're paying for that. You're also paying potentially for some of the services around it. Like they'll come out and replace the drive and there's an extended warranty and all of these interesting things. So there may be some value in what they're charging you above and beyond the consumer price.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move on and talk about the stats themselves then, because the most interesting thing about what you've done, apart from the fact that you built your own storage environment, is the fact that you've been collecting stats pretty much, I would imagine, from day one about the hard drives you've been putting in there. And every quarter, I think you produce those as a summary online when people can actually download the data. So tell us how that came about.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, you're half right there. We actually collected this data almost from day one, and we'd keep it for about 30 days, and then we'd delete it because it's a lot of data. And then back in 2013 or so, somebody, and it wasn't me, you know, somebody around the table said, well, what if we kept it? What could we learn? And so we said, well, let's find out. And so we started keeping it. What we're doing is we're taking what's called the smart stats. So each drive produces a set of statistics about itself, and you can query that. And there's utilities that do that. And it comes back and it says, and there's some, let's call it some standardization as to what's reported for each statistic. So smart stat number one means a certain thing, and smart stat number two means a certain thing, and so on and so forth. And there are roughly 255 of them or something like that. And a given drive might report anywhere from 20 or 30 to 50 or 60 of them. And so we were keeping that for each drive, that data. So, you know, keep the serial number and so on and so forth, and its status. And we were keeping that for each drive in the data center once a day. Now we do it all, we were doing this routine, running these stats 3 and 4 times and 5 times a day, as a way of monitoring the drives, but we were keeping one set. And so back in 2013, in April of 2013, we started keeping this. And we got about a year's worth of data. And somebody said, you know, there's some really interesting things in here. We can start to look at things like failure rates and versus different models. We can start to look at things like temperature. What's the internal temperature of a drive? Is it correlated to failure or not? Do certain drive models run hotter than other drive models and so on? And, you know, we started to look at the stats like that. And about, like I said, sometime in 2014, we started printing these quarterly stats related to exactly those kinds of things. Whether, you know, whether a given drive model has a failure profile or it fails at a higher rate than other ones and so on. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
So the smart data is, I think, really quite interesting because, as you said, first of all, it's not consistent between different manufacturers. Some will report some data and some will not report it. And that's a bit variable. So I guess you've got to take that into consideration. But once you've got the data, I guess the fun bit is trying to find out what you can come up with creatively from that. And having, I think, things like temperature and so on, it does give you that ability to try and find some sort of correlation.
Yeah, and some of them are fairly consistent too. I don't remember the numbers right off the top of my head, but you know, there are things like write errors. So if I'm going to be writing because I get a reject because of a media error, you know, once you start getting those, that's something you need to pay attention to. I don't care what the drive model is. That means you have something wrong with the section of a platter, you know, an area there. And while the firmware of the system will work around that, it can be indicative of something that's really bad for the entire platter or the entire drive. And so you begin to pay attention to those things. The other thing we did with them, of course, is when a drive failed, in other words, whenever we removed a drive from the system because it failed, it stopped spinning or, you know, won't hook up to our RAID array or whatever the case may be, that we would record that failure. And so that's how we got to the whole notion of, you know, how good drives were. So we had, you know, if you had 10 drives and one of them failed, you know, you could begin to compute a percentage. Now, we compute something called an annualized failure rate. And it's based on some two things, so the number of failures and the number of days the drive model, all of the drives in that drive model are in business, basically. So they're operational. And the reason we do it that way is because we have drives coming and leaving the system all of the time. You know, new drives are being introduced, but they're the same model as an old one. So you can't use just the number of drives because then you're not contributing properly each drive. You know, so if a drive has only been running for 3 months, it's contributed 3 months worth of data versus another drive, which is running for 4 years and it's contributing 4 years worth of data. And if you just use the drive count, you're not counting correctly. You're basically saying they're equal. So we use drive days to compute that out.
Okay. Something that just sprung to mind there within that data and within the process of how you see drives fail. And that's in the enterprise, certainly from my experience, I'm sure you've probably seen the same, Martin. A lot of the time drives would be proactively failed because the RAID overhead of rebuilding that lost drive would be high. So you really want to minimize the impact. And secondly, if you get a second failure in older RAID groups, then you potentially have data loss. Do you just fail drives flat or do you try and retire a drive gracefully if you think that you see something going wrong with it?
So if we see something going wrong, you know, yours is a good example. A drive won't stay in a RAID array. Is it really, you know, that happens for any number of different reasons. And so that drive comes out. At that point, we're not going to, you know, if we start to see problems with it along those lines, it won't stay engaged, so to speak. Or if it starts to throw a fair number of media errors, okay, you pull that drive out. Now, what we do with any of those that are still spinning is we run them through a secondary and actually a tertiary check on the backside. But we want to avoid that issue that you're talking about of failing too many drives in an array. For us, it's we run in a 17-3 pattern, and so we can fail three drives in a given array before we have to worry. The interesting thing is as drives have gotten larger, they take longer and longer to get reengaged into that, you know, into the setup. So you got an 8 terabyte drive; it can take a couple of weeks for it to get redone. So what ends up happening is when a drive comes out now, the first thing we try to do is clone it because cloning only takes a day.
That's an interesting approach. I guess, Martin, I mean, you think about, I don't know what you do day to day, but I would always want to avoid failing a drive because I knew the rebuild would take forever. But if it's now taking weeks and weeks and you can clone a drive in a day, cloning just seems like quite a smart move.
It is a smart move. It's an interesting one. It's got to be down to some clever software which allows you to clone a drive, which is part of an array. But yeah, it's a very smart move. Very clever.
Yeah. It was obviously it means that the drive has to be spinning and you're not probably going to get 100% off of what you need. But if I can get, you know, 50, 60, 70%, I've just saved myself 2 to 3 weeks of rebuild time potentially. So if that second drive fails in that array, which is, you know, that's the odds start going up incrementally, right? Or exponentially. for that. I'm not behind anymore, you know, so that's the whole idea. So anything we can do to keep that array in great shape is, you know, by reducing the time for rebuilds in any way, shape or form is a good thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, the rebuild times on these large drives are beginning to become killers. Certainly in enterprise class arrays, you can see a RAID rank rebuild into 3 or 4 days, depending on how it's how its RAID's been distributed.
Yep.
And I guess we're not going to see any real improvement of that with SMR drives. There's not like anybody's thought to build in like a backdoor rebuild access point, which would be really useful. We're really still depending on the front end of the device to actually do the reads and the rebuilds.
Yeah, the SMR drives have a different set of challenges. They're really great for our recording just stuff because they're much easier and straightforward to do that. But when you get into the whole erase and want to put new data back in, the process almost grinds to a halt. and so, you know, so rebuilding one of those things can be a little tricky. And so we actually don't use SMR drives for exactly that reason. It just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the right, our profile as we work it.
Yeah, I guess you'd also have to do a certain degree of software amendments to make it work, because I think a lot of the drives have an additional software interface to allow you to make sure you get around some of that performance issue of writing the SMR format. So the drive almost needs to be managed in a certain way, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Brilliant. So let's talk about the data in a bit more detail then. What interesting stuff have you found, and how can people interpret the results of the data that you get out?
Well, I think the thing that we do is when we produce it, we produce each quarter, as you said, we produce the results from the latest quarter. So just the data that's happened over the last 3 months. Then we usually do it for the lifetime. And then every once in a while, just for the fun of it, I'll put in just an annual one. And so I think that's the first thing people need to take a look at is okay, so I'm looking at a table that says I'm covering quarterly results. So and we look at quarterly results as just nothing more than a trend or a potential trend. So did it go up this quarter? Did it go down this quarter? The failure rates of something, has it basically stayed the same? And that's very helpful, obviously, because drives as a group have a tendency to behave like that, almost in a herd mentality, right? Where they'll be going along fine and then, you know, let's just say 4 years out, they start to develop a little age on them. And suddenly, instead of failing at 2%, they're now failing at 3.5%, you know? And so you have to start thinking about, well, all right, that's still a fine number, but it's going the wrong way. You know, so how do we want to work this into our strategy of increasing density and so on and so forth? And we do that all of the time. We're always constantly trading that back and forth. You know, so that's the first thing you can look for when you look at the data that's out there. We do it by model. We used to do it by manufacturer, but to be honest, most of the drives these days are Seagate, although that's starting to change. So it's unfair to just pull Seagate out and put up, 100 Western Digital drives against it. But we do it by model number. The thing to remember about model numbers are when we order drives, we order, let's just say 10,000 of them, pick a number out of the air. You're buying one. And so you may or may not be able to find that model number. And just because it says, one at the end instead of two doesn't mean anything about those two models being similar.
that's a fair point for anybody who's listening to what we're saying and thinking that they should look at those stats and decide that there's a strategy in how they should purchase their own 5 or 6 drives to buy at home, because you might be buying drives that actually don't exist in the consumer market and just can't get hold of.
Normally they're available someplace, but a lot of times they're not, and that's a very valid point. You know, so the statistics are great to look at. They're good for personality kind of things. And to be honest with you, there's precious little data out there like this anywhere. So, even a lot of sites that used to do hard drive reviews are not doing them anymore. You know, Tom's Hardware, which is one of my favorite sites and still is, stopped doing hard drive reviews, about a year ago. You know, they're focusing on SSDs, which makes perfectly good sense. So when you're going out to buy a hard drive, Well, there isn't a lot of information out there. So this is one of the things you can at least get your teeth on. And I wouldn't make, you know, don't make your buying decision on it, but at least use it as part, you can use it as part of your portfolio of things that you, information that you want to use when you go out and buy a drive.
Yeah. So Martin, what do you think about, do you use this data?
I do. I've used it in my day job in the past where somebody's turned around and said, oh, we think we've seen a lot of drive failures. And I'll be looking at it and I'll look at Backblaze's figures. I should do some comparison. And most of the time, what people think are a lot of drive failures aren't really a lot of drive failures at all. We obviously don't have anywhere near the number of drives or drive days which Backblaze have, but we do have several thousand, probably substantially more than that. So we can get some idea. So if I suddenly saw a drive failure rate of 6-7%, I'd start to worry. But when it's still dropping down about 1-2%, certainly if it's less than 2%, I've really used these figures to say, actually, I don't really think there's a great problem. You just perceive it because you've seen two drive failures very close together. That's what normally worries people. They don't really understand that you, to a certain extent, you have to look over a lifetime of a drive model, not just when you get two failures in 2 weeks.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, though, do you care that much about drive failures, or do you push it back to the vendor? I mean, do you have enough of an infrastructure where you have to care about individual drive failures yourself?
The only reason I care about drive failures is I see a lot of them I would have reliability issues. And also just, I don't want the vendor's engineers in and out of the building replacing drives every day because it's a pain raising that level of access requests.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Yeah, absolutely. So, Andy, I guess as we're thinking about this and talking about some of these, you just mentioned about two things I think really interesting about, you know, different drives and groupings, and also the whole issue with Thailand and how drives went, or how the supply dried up over there when they had their incident. Do you see any correlation in terms of manufacturing? And I'll explain why. So, you know, one of the things that people always panicked and worried about was, say, SSDs and some hard drives, was that if the drives were manufactured at the same time and put into the equipment at the same time, they might all fail at the same time rather than failing randomly. But, you know, can you see any evidence for such an urban myth?
So one of the things that we did an analysis, and it's been a couple of years since we've updated it, but we saw the infamous bathtub curve, you know, with a population of drives. And so that, you know, basically that means that early on the drives fail a somewhat higher rate. Then they settle in, you know, 6 months to a year out into a failure rate that kind of runs at whatever it is, let's just say 1%, just to pick a number. And that will run for a period of time. And then let's just say a couple of years. And then at three and a half years or so, that failure rate starts to come up and just keeps going up, or, you know, potentially levels off, but usually it starts to rise. And by that time, you're in, you know, 4, potentially 5 years. And we see that. So there is something to be said for the fact that, okay, so I bought a model of drives, I bought 100 of them, they're all running fine, and then one fails 3 years out. And so there's that sense that more failure is coming. And it's, you know, is it a big number? Is jumping from 1% to 2% a big number? Well, it kind of depends on how many drives you have. But there is that notion that, you know, later on in life, drives will just start to fail at a higher rate than earlier on in life. And drives will, in general, do that. Now, that being said, you'll buy a drive, you'll put it in your computer at home, it'll run for 7 years, you don't care. Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean, and that is the trouble. When you look at this data, either as a consumer or as an enterprise or a large customer, you have to really think what the stats are showing you in that scenario.
I was going to say, I was pleased to hear that the bathtub is actually true, because I constantly tell my senior directors things like that. We'd expect early life failure, then we expect everything to run quite happily, and then as things start to get old and aged, we expect to see things starting to fail a bit more often, so we should be looking at refreshes then. It's good to hear that that's borne out in your experience.
Yeah, it has. Every once in a while, we pick up something that just doesn't fail early on, but they all seem to have the tail at the end, which makes sense. There's no drives, you know, drives don't last forever. They're going to start failing, and so you should have a plan for that. You know, and the other reality of all of these numbers is, you know, we have a great setup, just like I'm sure you do, for making sure things are backed up. Okay, so we have everything in RAID and all of that, and we have, you know, so we can reproduce anything we need to. That's our business. when you're at home with your one computer or your small business or whatever, don't rely on a single drive. You know, just please back up your stuff. I don't care how you do it. Just get your stuff backed up. Make sure it's in at least, you know, we always tell people about 3-2-1, right?
Yeah.
You know, three copies. Your data doesn't exist until you have three copies of it in two different types of things. And then, you know, and then the last one is get one copy offsite if you can do it. Whether that's cloud storage or online backup, or whether you put everything on optical disk and mail it to your Aunt Clara, you know, it's entirely up to you. But that's, you know, that's the best strategy. Beats the heck out of picking the right drive. just get it backed up.
It sounds like somebody's been talking about my backup strategy of using optical drives. No, I honestly do not use optical drives. I actually do backup to the cloud, and I do take at least two other copies. So thank goodness I can cross my fingers and say, yeah, I follow your methodology, definitely. As we sort of come to the end of our discussion, let's just talk about how that data then transferred into something that you could use to help you evolve the platform a bit more. So what did you learn from the data that allowed you either to, say, improve the quality of the pods or to choose better drives, or, you know, when you went out there and looked for which models to go for? What did you sort of learn from that?
That's a really good question. The first thing we went through was we found out very early on that not all drives fit on our environment, drive models. And so part of the instrumenting the drives the way we do helps us determine that. For example, some of the drives are, you know, like I'll just use the Western Digital Green drives. We originally used those. They're 1 terabyte ones and they were great. Okay. But then we started to use them in the larger sizes, and they didn't work well in our environment. And the reason primarily was is that as a green drive, it liked to kind of, you know, when it wasn't doing anything, it would kind of say, hey, I'm going to save a little energy. I'm going to spin the drives down, right?
Yeah.
And so, but in our environment, that didn't happen a lot. And so the drive would go, you know, would be idle for 10 seconds. And then so we'd spin it down and then bang, we'd spin it back up. You know, their expectation was you spun it down because you walked away from the computer. But in our environment, so it was constantly up and down and up and down. And that's pretty taxing on one of those things. And so that drive didn't work well. Those drives didn't work well in our environment.
That's a really interesting example, because if you look back at the early days of MADE, when MADE first came in, companies like Copan and various others, they were spinning down whole sections of the array to do that. And I remember having lots of discussions with the vendor saying, well, is that safe? Is that a good thing to do, to spin drives up and down? And of course, unless you sit down and think about the impact of your application and workload, I mean, they did because that was their platform, so they must have done. But if you don't think about your application and your workload, that can be a real issue.
Yeah, and you know that was a classic example of that. The other thing we had was, you know, one of the things people always worried about in our environment was vibration. So we would monitor the drives because they have a smart stat for that, or some of them do, and we would monitor that and see if vibration, at least as the drives were monitoring themselves, was detectable. You know, so, and we never saw that, by the way. We never saw it impact or be one of those influences or have anything into drive failure. You know, so if in fact the drive started to vibrate, it was random as to whether or not it would fail or not, and so on. So there was no correlation. So looking at those stats allowed us to, you know, because we could have spent a whole lot of engineering and over-engineered something just because of that accusation, but we could use the stats to kind of hold up and say, let's not go here. What the drives are telling us is this. Same thing with temperature. You know, everybody assumed. Now, many years ago, Google did a really good blog post about temperature, and we reaffirmed that in our data center as well, which is until it gets really, really hot, drives are pretty happy. you know, and we saw it about 45 degrees Celsius. It was kind of like the turning point where things started to go. Once a drive got up above there consistently, it was just going to, it was going to affect its failure rate. But up until you got there, it was pretty happy.
Mm. So it'd be interesting to understand how much you get involved with the manufacturers, because two things come to mind. First of all, the fact that you've got some great valuable data you could give back to them. But secondly, when you're purchasing, you clearly want to make sure now you're purchasing so many drives that you're making the right decision. So, you know, you almost want to not try before you buy, but you certainly want a process that allows you to make sure you're heading down that right route.
Yeah, so good question. We actually do try before we buy. you know, a new model comes down the road and, you know, or even just a new size, but the same thing. We have a strategy inside our organization where we run through and we will actually buy a handful of drives and we'll put them in a certain configuration and we'll test them for a month or so and see how they perform against each other and against the other drives that they're with. And then we'll increase that in, it's a different profile for the drives and how they're used in the system. And we'll increase the number of drives and we'll go through that exercise again. And then if we're happy with it, then we'll make an initial purchase. And an initial purchase is for a, what we call a vault, a Backblaze vault, which is 1,200 drives. And then kind of put that through its paces one more time. And then once we're happy with that, then we'll go and we'll buy, you know, a large quantity of them. So we do go through a process of breaking in drives, if you will, just to make sure we're comfortable with them. From the manufacturer's side, you know, we have different relationships with the different vendors, and there's only basically three now, right? You know, Toshiba, Western Digital / HGST, and Seagate. And so I'm not going to give away any secrets here, but some vendors are better than others to work with for that. And we have, you know, some of really excellent, excellent relationships with one of the vendors in particular. And then the other two we can work with as we need. It's been a little harder than we would like, but I think everybody's starting to come around and understand that what we have is exactly what you said, which is interesting, valuable information in a production environment that they can't get anywhere else. And, you know, or it's difficult for them to get. And, you know, and so it's been good over the years. Like I said, the vendors could have walked away and been really mad at us because we were publishing this data, you know, but I think the, you know, they're professional enough as organizations to realize that if they do it right, it's good information. It makes their products better. And not that we set out to do it, but I'm glad we could help.
So Andy, what about as we head forward? Obviously, technology-wise, people are going to be looking at things like QLC technology and whatever precedes QLC in the future, whether we get 5 bits of cell, 6 bits of cell, 7 bits of cell, we're moving towards flash being more and more theoretically affordable and economical. Well, what's your opinion about whether we'll move towards flash in the future and whether you might do that or whether you see a much longer life for hard drives?
Well, let's start with the life for hard drives. There was a really great study, a chart I saw that IDC had done, which basically, you know, forecasted the amount of data that we were going to need by 2025 and then be storing. So, and the number just goes up like by 4 times what we have today, right? And then they said, well, and it's going to be stored on these kind of media, and they broke it down by all of the different types of media, hard drives, SSDs, and so on. And hard drives were only going to be, according to them, storing half of that, which was something along the lines of, it was something like 11 zettabytes or whatever. It was just an insane amount of data, right? It was more than we currently had. So I don't think hard drives are going away anytime soon. You know, we have technologies coming down the road like the Hammer from Seagate and Mammer from Western Digital. It'll be fun to see how they prove out, you know, over the next couple of years, because that's how they're supposed to be getting to, you know, 50 terabyte hard drives and 100 terabyte hard drives potentially. But it's also going to be interesting to see what it does to the price, because you have technologies like SSDs, which are slowly coming down in price. You know, whether they actually ever get to the below or even close to hard drives is questionable. But from a, you know, a consideration of speed and so on, and potentially life, because I don't really know if we truly know the life expectancy in our environment, for example, of an SSD. It'll be interesting to see how those things happen. So I know, for example, we saw an article about a year or so ago where Facebook is using SSDs as part of their data structures for in their data centers. They can afford to do that, I guess. We've actually looked at it and thought about building a storage pod just to see. But the truth is, it's not a speed game for us, and because we can meet all of the requirements we need to, and that's actually where, you know, whether or not these things get adopted by, you know, companies like us is probably, that's probably the big gate. Do we really need the speed that SSDs afford us? If it's going to cost us more, is it worth it?
Yeah, I mean, people always say you pay for performance. capacity is free, but you pay for performance. So ultimately, if you don't need to pay for the performance, there's no point paying for it.
Capacity is free. Where is that? No.
Indirectly, yeah. On that subject and talking about performance, would you look at dual actuator drives?
So, yeah, we've talked to one of the companies about testing those out just to see what that would be like, you know, and seeing if that, you know, if we can get the performance, some additional performance without the price of an SSD. One of the things that's going to be interesting and over the next few years, and we ran into this recently with the helium drives, right? Helium is coming along, and a lot of the bigger drives are helium now. We had a helium drive here that crashed, okay, and we wanted to see if we could recover the data off of it. This was just an exercise. It was already being rebuilt and everything. So we cloned it and everything. And then we turned the drive over to one of the local operations here that does, you know, drive rescue. And we wanted to see what happened. And they basically said, we can't do anything with this. We can clone it. And I said, well, we already did that. And the reason is, of course, is because it's sealed. And as soon as you unseal it, everything crashes. Okay. And you basically destroyed the drive. You know, suddenly you start thinking about that and you say, all of these great new technologies are going to be depot level repair only, you know, and that's different because right now you have companies, you know, like Kroll on Track and Drive Savers and so on that can actually save some data off of a 4 terabyte drive that might have crashed. And is all of that going to go away?
It's got some really interesting implications actually outside of the data recovery. We're actually still in data recovery for forensic recovery. So if you want to destroy data on a helium drive, drill into it and it's all going to crash and it's going to make life even harder for people to recover the data from.
Yeah, absolutely. So it'll and now do that with something that's got, you know, a hammer drive with a little laser read write head.
Yeah.
You know, and figure out who's going to be repairing that.
Yeah, I guess that's the inevitability of the technology getting ever more complex.
Yeah. Now, you know, if you look back though, if you had been 20 years ago and you had said, okay, so what are you going to be able to recover off of a hard drive? Nobody would have thought about the kind of aerial densities and technology that we're working on today and be able to say that you could bring it down to a local shop and they could get data off of it by taking it apart and spinning that platter on a whole new system or re-recording it. You know, those were not thoughts 20 years ago. So eventually we catch up to it. But for the next several years, it's probably going to be a real challenge.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, if people are interested, Andy, in finding out more about the stats, looking them up, even downloading them and doing some analysis themselves, where can they go?
Well, I'll give you the URL, and then if you can maybe list it for them to make it a little easier, that would be great. It's
Absolutely.
On our website, www.backblaze.com/B2/hard-drive-test-data. .html. Apologize for that, but that's where we put them. And that's got everything on there, including all of the reports that we've done over the years. And then if you scroll down through there, it'll tell you about the data and the fields that are in there and everything. And then they can go and download the data. We do break it up by either a year or even by quarter because the files are kind of large. And we didn't want you to be trying to download a couple of terabytes worth of data, you know, in one chunk. So you have to spend the day taking it down piece by piece. And then you'll have everything I have to go play with.
Brilliant. Okay. Appreciate it, Andy. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been really interesting. Hopefully we can catch up in the future and talk about another aspect of this at another time, or when you'd get the next batch of drives, or when you've got the next interesting thing to talk to us about. But we certainly enjoyed it, and hope to catch up with you soon.
Yeah, and thank you, Chris, and thank you, Martin. It was fun to be here today, and look forward to talking to you in the future.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com, follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.